Hi, welcome to Contemporary Communications Conference. My name is Jerry Fielka. We welcome today Jeffrey Hill, psychotherapist, social critic, and author of the book Illuminating Shadows, The Mythic Power of Film, and Bob Dobbs, a mixed corporate media and author of the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Let's discuss the use of satire. How have artists and writers used satire to make their point? Gentlemen, begin.
That's the first example.
Yeah. Well, I happen to think that satire is a very, very dangerous thing that is for the establishment. However, from a subversive angle, I think it happens to be one of the most healthy things on the face of the earth.
Well, since we live a very ironical existence due to the multiplicity of media replaying ourselves back to ourselves, an ironic position is inevitable, so I think there's the line on the liner notes of Bob's Mediacology. Maybe you have it there, Jerry. Isn't something that Nelson says, that quoting Wyndham Lewis, that in an age where everybody is forced to be a satirist, then the ordinary truth cannot be said in conversation? Maybe you can find that quote at some point, Jerry.
But what do you think that means, Bob?
Well, I think that everybody is forced into a cynical, or let's say ironic, maybe not cynical, it eventually becomes cynical, ironic position, because our images of ourselves are translated through so many media that we lose a reference point, which the postmodernists have gone into, and irony is inevitable in every position, so you could say that people live their lives today with a soundtrack going on in their heads, I mean a laugh track going on in their heads all the time, and in response to the news, so that makes it very hard to be a satirist about that situation. I mean, the fact that people are amusing themselves to death.
That's a good point. I think that irony or satire is really a rather natural principle of the universe, it seems. In other words, when things get too static and too immovable, I think nature herself somehow promulgates a certain amount of irony to twist things around to create a new balance.
Yeah, having read your article on the soul, what was the title of your article? I read Magical
Stealing Souls and Making Zombies in a Postmodern Culture.
Yeah, and I'd like to once at some point talk about what is a soul, but the essence of humanity seems to be a self-consciousness, that the condition of existence of humans is to be self-conscious. It seems to be different from other parts of creation. They don't have the kind of self-consciousness we have. So if you think of self-consciousness and the ability to look at yourself and what you're doing, that reflectiveness, that mirroring, would make irony, like you're saying, an essential nature of the human soul.
Yes. Well, do you think, Bob, that satire, which I consider more of a militant form, a militant purposeful form of irony, do you think that it comes in cycles at particular times in mass consciousness? I mean, more so than in other times?
Okay. First of all, mass consciousness, we have to define that. I mean, a tribe united by the mass medium of speech has that condition. But today people think of the anonymous millions of audiences for collective media as mass man or mass humanity. So do you mean today cycles within the 20th century of mass media? Because I think there's always been irony and satire in human communication.
Well, yes, that's always true, but I guess what I'm really leading up to, it seems to me that when society gets too serious, when we take ourselves too seriously, when things get almost allergic to dynamics as opposed to the static aspect of life, it seems that there's an inevitable eruption of satire to kind of switch things around somewhat.
right, then could we see there's such a decentralized society today that there's a cycle or a continuum, let's say not a cycle, a continuum of seriousness. The mythic stage of seriousness is presented in certain media, maybe the editorial pages of the New York Times or the White House. The powerful, in political terms, have to always put on a dull face to mask the position of their power. And then there's the constant bombardment of entertainment, which is satirizing all kinds of things from sitcoms to Broadway musicals to rock and roll or anything in the entertainment world. That is a constant cycle of satire. But I think what you mean is in the world of what I call the word makes a mark, in the general trends of societies as manufactured and measured by polls, then we get into trends, right? You're saying in trends, like looking over the past 30 years?
Yeah, I would say so. In other words, in the general state of consciousness of the collective soul, if we can say that, it seems that, for example, at this particular time in Western consciousness, we happen to be taking ourselves far too seriously, and thus we become militarized and overly organized, almost at the exclusion of, shall we say, the funny bone of life.
All right. Now, you got to look at the groups, the mini-states. I think that people today are addicted to having a sense of humor or to being entertained too much, and that's what I call the software world. And that makes the hardware part of society, our industrial, military, mythic states that we've inherited from the last couple hundred years, they feel threatened by this lack of serious hardware purpose in the general population due to them being drunk on software entertainment. And so they feel that seriousness is at a low premium right now, so they are feeling threatened. Now, you're talking about that mythic stage, those people who represent that purpose, that sense of purpose of that structure, that mini-state of society, interacting with all the other constant satirical communication that's going on in all forms of entertainment. We've got a clash here of mini-states. So I think the industrial stage would have a point about people are not taking things serious anymore. That's probably the appeal of Rush Limbaugh. And then there's those who have invested interest in entertainment industries think that people should lighten up. They're both speaking from their own mythic stage and not being comprehensive.
I think what I'm saying is that I think the reason why we have so much entertainment, that is so much humorous entertainment, and since the industry of comedy seems to be on the rise, is because we have taken ourselves too seriously.
Yeah, this is the software release from the hardware of the Gutenberg galaxy.
That's right.
Yeah, I'd say the Marconi laugh is what we're going through now.
Yes.
The Marconi galaxy. But I think as people go through this in their 30s, 40s, 50s, at different stages of their biological lifespan, they get to a sense of having enough. They've had enough. I think 40, 50-year-old people, I think as far as on theater, says the 90s are the 60s upside down. So you have the older generation angry at the indifference in different ways, manifested in different ways of the younger generation, where it was reversed in the 60s, right? The young people felt the older people were indifferent. So I think it's the aging of the baby boomers, or even those older, who have absorbed 30, 40 years of software bombardment and entertainment, don't get affected and are not as involved in it as young people are. Young people are addicted to self-expression right now. So that's...
Well, I think the problem is ties in with a key word that you mentioned, which is entertainment. The way I see it is that it seems that we are being entertained to death with, as you call it, this software entertainment. But the satire that's there is really not necessarily, shall we say, biting satire of a healthy variety. Rather, it's just kind of too loose and clownish without any directed goal or purpose.
Yeah, it's nihilistic.
Yeah. And I think what we actually would rather need would be something that would do something to shall we say, reconstruct society in a better way.
Well, I maintain that Bob's Meat Ecology is outlined on that album released by Nelson Thal and Dave Neufeld, does offer a satirical, purposeful situation of turning off television for, say, a couple of weeks, a few months. That's a satirical program with a purpose.
Would
deal with your situation you're complaining about, the mainstream giddiness.
Yes. And the problem, however, with a lot of the people in the mainstream is that they don't often understand satire. To give you an example, during the Gulf massacre, I wrote up a cynical, satirical piece on the New World Order. I sent a copy to my aunt who lives in Spain, and she was a supporter of Franco, if that tells you anything about her, and very much supportive of the whole massacre in Iraq. And when I sent her this piece, she wrote back and she says, "I'm offended that you sent that to me. It's very sarcastic." And I laughed and I said, "Well, thank you very much for calling it sarcastic. That's kind of like calling a clown funny." In other words, you have the ability to really state the obvious.
But see, that's the complexity, since anybody who's in the media represents a demographic or a mythic stage by their personality or their history, then the people that identify with that person feel threatened by any attack on that person. So they're not humorous about attacks on that person, but they might be able to take sarcastic relief from something that they perceive as their enemy being satirized. So you get these cross directions of audiences, amused by some things, but not amused by others. So she obviously didn't think that that was a socially redeeming sarcasm, though she probably imagines she has a good sense of humor in other parts of life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, to some degree. Yes.
So you got to be aware of the confusion that's going on. That's the ground we're in, this mixed confusion of lifestyles and image replays and representations of various people's lifestyles. In that confusion, it's hard for people to communicate.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. It's like we're all speaking different languages in the same language.
Yeah, and she probably doesn't understand what you said to me, your response to her. She didn't understand that probably.
Yes, yes.
So that's the confusion that the Tower of Babel we need to program, if it's possible. It may not be possible.
It seems that we're in, if we can view consciousness, that is mass consciousness, in a cyclical form, it seems that we're very much in the throes of a death-like winter, in which case I think we need more satire to kind of bring us into the spring of existence again.
But when you say we, you have to be mindful of what we you're talking about. I mean, I immediately can think, and I don't want to harp on it, of people that would disagree with you that see a rebirth in certain things that they prefer. And other people who don't agree with that or identify with it see a depression in their interest. So, you know, what we are you putting on?
I would say most of us generally, I don't take myself literally when I say we. In other words, I don't necessarily put myself in the category.
That's a key point there. You don't put your. You're not including yourself. You're actually talking about something that language is talking about, not you.
Are you taking me literally?
Yeah. Well, you did say you didn't include yourself in the we.
Yeah.
You mean that?
I guess this is the problem when two satirists get together and talk.
Yeah, they end up explaining the joke never gets said.
Are we to be believed?
Do you believe in your blooming world, Bob?
I was just going to say that, Mr. Fialdo.
Now let's get serious here. The poet Auden said this quote, and maybe you guys can comment on it. Satire is angry and optimistic. It believes that once people's attention is drawn to some evil, they will mend their ways.
Well, I think that television is a medium. I think we've got to look at the forms of the media. The forms are doing the satire. This is actually what I talk about in my liner notes, the Baroque spiles of each archetypal medium, which I call a mythic stage. As television absorbs movies and newspapers and eats all that media stuff, and then movies make films about the effects of television on people. Each medium uses its own bias and advantage to mirror and echo and satirize what they see going on in the effects of other media, then I don't see how we can have a hegemonic satirical position. Other than what, a big joke in all of them would be to turn it off, wouldn't it? I mean, it would put all these guys up, those news anchors who are always giving us statistics on unemployment and all the problems we have every day, let's put them out of work.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It seems to me that satirists, in a healthy sense of the word, are really very much like divine tricksters that are somehow appointed by the gods, as it were, to come down and flip things around, to turn things upside down so that we can get on with life in a better way.
Oh, yeah, I'd agree with that. That's traditional role of the trickster and the satirist. And also they probably, as we got into the mass media of the last 500 years, their satire was not as evident at the time and may have been stronger in communication 200 years later, like Gulliver's Travels and things like that. You know, the pointedness of their satire and the obviousness of it actually might have a delay. I think that might be the fate of Frank Zappa's work, that he was satirizing things that people didn't even know he was satirizing other than the obvious content, and that'll be understood maybe in 50 years.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we're only recently understanding people like Lenny Bruce, but there's been a saying floating around in the comedy industry for years which says Lenny died for our sins, which I think is an indication that he really was very much of a messiah within the, shall we say, the subversive community.
Or bohemia, yeah.
Yeah.
And, there's Harvey Cox wrote a book on Jesus and his satirical levels of meaning in the 60s. So some theologians could see that in religion. In, let's say, Western religion, I think the trickster aspect was more understood and accepted in pre-literate cultures, tribal cultures, tiny cultures, I guess we call them.
Yes. Yeah, we often forget that we need the jester in the court. But I found something really interesting when George Bush was going out of office, and he's, of course, certainly no fan of mine. I mean, no...
he didn't buy your book.
I mean, I'm no fan of his. But at any rate, he did something I thought was rather surprising and healthy, in that he invited the guy from Saturday Night Live that imitates him?
Dana Carvey.
He invited him to go spend the night at the White House, and he invited him to essentially do his gesturing in the royal court, so to speak.
Yeah.
Which I thought that's a very surprising and healthy insight for a president to do something like that.
Well, that's because the private George Bush is probably a lot different than the image he's forced to portray in the role of president or as a politician. I mean, that's not a private person who's communicating to us through the media every day. If this is not the private Bill Clinton we're experiencing. This is a agglutination of all the meanings of the various phases of history of the president into today's meaning. So, I mean, there's no private Bill Clinton. As Dave Worcester once said to me, President Reagan never got into trouble until he expressed his private point of view, which was often caught, you know, let's bomb Russia, this kind of stuff, before he went into his public role. So we've got to get away from the confusion between public and private awarenesses, and I think you're seeing George Bush, the private person, inviting Carvey there.
Yeah, I suppose in his last few minutes in office, he felt that he could finally show his true face.
Yeah. Well, show his private face. You could say, true private.
Yes,
but
yes.
His true public face is another matter.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they're both rather true.
Yeah, they're relative truths and relative context. And I think that's one thing that young people, since 1945, are never helped to understand in their education, is the complexity of the society they're in. And I think if they understood the grounds of the different media responsibilities of different mythic stages that we've inherited at this point in our global theater, if they understood and were presented this intelligently in classes, they wouldn't be so despondent. They wouldn't take the world so personally. Now, I know it's hard for a young person not to take the world personally, but they're not encouraged today to understand the confusion of private and public awareness as they grow up.
Yes, that's right. So how can we educate the masses in that regard, if we want to do that?
Well, I do it in my radio show, but I don't want to harp on me, but I just think that it would require, and the Marshall McLuhan Center in Global Communications in Toronto would offer advice on how to set up a curriculum and to do that. But whether the educational system would adopt it is another point, because the educational system is, in a sense, evaporated. The literate structure, the school structure, is a very minor teaching machine, teaching environment, compared to the mixed corporate media environments that people live in and grow up in. So I think that every institution, including education, is in a defensive position and are holding on and trying to prop up the meaning and traditional value of their occupations, and are actually quite rigid to, say, quite demanding new changes in how to present their curriculum. That's another problem, is the electric software environment bombards everybody. It makes everybody conservative within their own tradition, their own job. They get really rigid. So, Marsh McLuhan presented his, he wrote even a book about, for schools called City as Classroom, where he presented this kind of information, and it, it never got adopted on a very wide scale. So Marshall said the answers, 20th century man is a man running down the street saying, I have the answers, I've got all the answers, but what are the questions?
Right. Well, besides the fact that that we do take ourselves too seriously with all of these seeming answers, I think most of us are...
Yeah, now that's where I'd agree with you. What I just said is what you mean by taking ourselves too seriously. We're all on the defensive in relation to our traditional roles.
Yes. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why we need the jester back in the court, as it were. I think besides...
The jester would be to turn off the jester, which is television. I mean, that's the timid giant. That's the timid clown.
Well, the problem, though, is that the jester that I think that we see on television is an ironic jester in an... it's almost a double irony. In other words, even news, of course, ends up being entertainment, and the talking heads on the newscast are really the jesters in irony.
That's right. Now, they're the postmodern content jesters, the self-referential jesters. Now, that's on the content. When I say television, I mean the very fact that it is an environment, this simultaneous processing of information day in and day out. That fact, that form, rather than whatever content goes on in whatever culture of the TV, that is what we need to orchestrate. So yes, it's very hard to turn off the television environment as form, we have a very self-ironical, self-conscious, postmodern situation.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just merely a perpetual copying of copies.
Yeah. And everybody eventually can become aware of that, so they actually become a pretty good amateur satirist themselves.
Yeah.
Then actually flips into its opposite and turns everybody off. So you have this culture turning to stone.
Yeah. Well, I'm totally with you on eliminating as much television as we possibly can.
Only temporarily, because it actually has a good has services as well as disservices.
Yeah.
I think it's been allowed to run amok, and we should orchestrate it like we would a good painting.
Yes. I often wonder if, for example, people like Jerry Mander, who wrote The Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, I often wonder if he was really serious about that. Can we actually eliminate something like television? I mean, it's like eliminating radio or computers or something.
Yeah, I know that Marshall McLuhan was disgusted with his book, and Jerry Mander's new book, I can't remember the title.
In the Absence of the Sacred.
Yes. I looked up his references to Marshall McLuhan in that, and he has a new appreciation of Marshall, a new understanding of his work. So actually, this book, the understanding he acquires in this book is the beginning of him now adopting Marshall's media ecology. But the reason Marshall didn't approve of that strategy was it was too extreme. You have to state the services of television as well as the disservices.
Yes.
And then there would be a collective agreement. Yes, we understand the good and bad of the situation, and we can afford to turn it off for a while.
Right.
And Mander was too much of an extremist.
Yeah, when we try to correct a situation, sometimes we can become just as literal and perhaps as fascistic as the fascists that perpetuate the problem.
Yeah, that seems to be a common symptom of all institutions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what they propose to be their purport to be their serious purpose, in a therapeutic level, they take it too seriously. It flips into its opposite.
Yes.
That's the hardest thing for people to be, is to be flexible in self-consciousness like that. And that is the role of humor. It's therapeutic, and satire is to help people do that, because it is the hardest thing for people to be. You know, to flip from serious to not serious.
Exactly. Just like, you know, we often assume that people on the progressive bent of society are really the healthy ones. That is, if you lean in that direction. And yet they're the ones who often are just as fascistic in their political correctness that they try to impose on the rest of us.
That's right. And because television can pick up a little symptom in society so quickly and make it collective, almost like a global Esperanto, that symptom of the progressives has been hoiked up and ridiculed over the last few years.
Yes, right. And
how to react to that.
And possibly for good reason.
Yeah, I think TV's going to do it to you. This is where TV's the jester. It will do it to whoever you are.
Yes.
Even if you've got the cure for cancer, it's going to be done to you.
Right.
And you have to be aware of that and have an imaginative responses to that. And so you have to realize it's therapeutic, take it with a grain of salt, have a sense of humor, but also counter it with an awareness of the process.
Yes.
And the political correct progressives certainly failed in that. And Rush Limbaugh wins at this point.
Yeah. Now there's an example of a jester that, in my opinion, is actually working toward the destruction of society.
Yeah, there's a lot of disservices in what he does, and yet you can't deny the services, because the jester siphons off the frustrations of society.
Yeah.
And the political correct have created certain frustrations in people due to their lack of awareness of media, and Rush Limbaugh filled the gap and gave the release of it.
Yes.
And now the some part of the anti-Limbaugh reality, Limbaugh faction, whatever they're called, is trying to hoik up Howard Stern as an antidote to Limbaugh.
Exactly. And it's no coincidence that both of them are on the bestseller list, up at the top one and two, I think, now.
Yeah, the pattern expressed by a recent columnist is that as Perot upset the political pundits, or the software archetypes of commentary, the talking heads, the publishing industry has been upset by Stern and Limbaugh.
Well, Perot reminds me of another irony in our society at large, in that the American people demand an alternative to the norm, and they end up getting a billionaire ironic buffoon in the name of Perot.
Well, that's a really ironic situation about Ross Perot, because it seems people realize government is managing huge industrial, archetypal, mythic stages. It's got a pivotal role in society. It's a complex role. And most people see it as not something you impose your personal opinion on, as I expressed earlier. And so they think that someone has to come out of the Big Brother apparatus to be a candidate. So Ross Perot, he had the American archetypal self-made man image, so he'd acquired the hardware abundance, but he also had been active in software espionage for the POWs and invading Iran and the various things he's done over the last 20 years supporting the military. He has that James Bond charisma, and so that's why it's strange that people will accept someone like him, because he seems qualified, because he's been in the world of the huge mixed corporate media long enough to acquire experience, what they perceive as experience. Like, there's no way an Abby Hoffman or Bill Mitchell could put on a society like Ross Perot did in a political context. That's the complexity we're in. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think so.
I mean, Ross Perot was a good antidote to the Big Brother world of Washington, and his part of his image was that he was a James Bond. He could spy on things. He had his own intelligence resources. He also had wealth and access to the boardrooms. So he was a hardware success. So he was a real complex image.
Instead of James Bond, he actually reminds me more of Alfred E. Newman.
Oh, yeah. He does look silly, you know, in his face. It's, of course, a whole demographic that he appeals to.
You know, besides the fact that we take ourselves far too seriously, I think another reason that we happen to be in what I call this dark wintry experience that erupts into natural satire is that I think another symptom of our society as a whole is the fact that we're in a massive state of denial, and thus that this brings on more natural irony and satire.
Yeah, well, we're in shock because we've amputated our central nervous system. The whole 20th century has been a denial of the fact that the electric media have amputated our central nervous system. And as Marshall wrote in his article in Playboy in December 68, mind your media, men, or you'll catch a cold environment. So he predicted the wintry situation we've peaked into right now.
Yes.
And the, what was I just saying there just before the wintry environment? The extension of central nervous. So at first we're in shock when we've been amputated, and then the medical symptom of resistance, and then trauma sets in, and then denial. So we are, you could use a medical metaphor for the collective soul that's experiencing the extension of itself, the amputation of a central nervous system. So this is understandable. And it's also a situation where it's a self-invasion of our collective privacy. So how are we going to deal with it? You know, this, I don't think, the reason comedy and satire has taken over as the laugh track of society is content playing catch up with the very numb situation we're in.
Yes. The alchemist had a phrase in Latin called in stercor in vinitur, which essentially means it is found in dung. And when they were looking for the philosopher's stone, they realized that it was often found in the midst of the cow doo-doo. And I think that was a reminder to them, and it should be a reminder to us that sometimes when we are in this state of denial, as if the S stuff does not happen, that lo and behold, there is the gold in the midst of it, oftentimes.
Right. The solution is often in the problem, and slang is often a guide in the popular language of what's happening. And so in the 60s, everybody tried to get their shit together.
Yes.
To pun on what you're talking about.
Yes.
Let's get our shit together.
Exactly.
Let's mutate it.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes there are pearls to be found there, and other times we end up just wallowing in it.
Yeah.
I'd like to remind our listeners we're listening to Jeffrey Hill and Bob Dobbs.
You know, Bob, here's another what I think is an interesting phenomenon that I have found myself into on a number of occasions. I've shared this with Jerry Fialka. I've found myself, for example, one time... I was coming back from Russia on a plane not too long ago, and the guy sitting next to me was reading Course of Miracles, and I struck up a conversation with him, and he seemed to be very intelligent and very articulate on the surface, yet it became rather obvious to me within 5 minutes of our conversation that most of what he was saying made absolutely no reasonable sense whatsoever. And so I thought, how am I going to, I could either just completely cut off this conversation, but then when I considered that, I realized that he was not capable of doing that. So I thought, well, he's not making any logic whatsoever, so I think I'll just join his game. And I started purposefully talking illogically, yet in a seemingly very intellectual fashion. And he didn't realize that I was actually engaging him in this little mind game, as it were.
Yeah.
And the problem is, I'm wondering if this is kind of a massive psychological disease that's endemic within our society. That, while we think that we're being rather logical, we're really not, and sometimes... we have to play irony with those that are too literal.
Yeah, the Cynthia, I would say the only occupants in the global theater are the mass media, the various archetypal media. So they're the occupants. Now, floating around the global theater in a discarnate or satellite state is each one of us. We have electric autonomy. And so we're in a position to watch the play of these of mass consciousness. And actually, since we each have 400 slaves, each one of us, in terms of technical services available to us, especially in the West, then we are in a position to be kings and queens who hallucinate. And I think we're free on the content level to hallucinate and invent any content, since we kind of have been removed from the main action of the scene, you know, on the global theater. Now, that's why people will communicate the way that person did to you. And I'm sure that person might have thought you were crazy, but didn't express it.
Well, actually, I asked this person after a while, after about 20 minutes into this illogical conversation we were having that wasn't going anyplace at all, yet he seemed to get a lot of enjoyment out of it. I did too, but my enjoyment was more of joining him in the, or engaging him in this game. But I eventually asked him, do you realize that I haven't been making any sense in the last 20 minutes?
And,
well, there was kind of a silence, like he was trying to think of, now what am I going to say? And he said, oh, yeah, I realized it. which made me wonder, I mean, my God, you know, if he really realized it and if he continued with it, then who's the fool? Are we both the fools? Or, you know, what is going on?
Well, there's the etiquette, the stress on etiquette, because this person may have a certain, depending on his background, a certain parameter, boundaries of what he tells in a social conversation and what he doesn't. And you may have an indicator, look, I can go further in intimacy than you may be prepared for or that you are willing to talk about, but I have forced you to acknowledge it, and he acknowledged it, and then he went back into a certain level of protectiveness.
Yes.
Which is, I can understand, is natural between strangers. So you got to be careful who you're talking. You can't. The diversity of experience, the subjectivity of people is so various. There's actually nothing to refer to now.
Yes.
Nothing in common. I mean, we do have the commonality. The global Esperanto is the media experience itself.
Mm-hmm.
But each one of us is editing our own content that we call consciousness or subjectivity. And just think of the mutation that's creating individually on us. It's almost like mutation as an art form. I mean, Terence McKenna's dreams of the future mutation of consciousness and freedom of subjectivity are puny compared to what people are already going through and collecting in their own brains.
Well, it seems that when society itself doesn't seem to make sense, that's when we need to, join the crowd and hopefully make other people realize that it really does not make sense.
Well, yeah, it does make sense. There is an order to it, but if the order is being abused, then it appears not to make sense. But I can see there's a communication ecology. I can see how everything, and I do this in my Tetrad management, I can see how everything balances out and cross-cancels, and I think we could say that the hyper-computerized TV satellite environment saved us from nuclear war because it put all the global cultures on LSD. They all were hallucinating, therefore created a kind of paranoia, and nobody actually could take one agenda and ram it through and create World War III.
It makes you wonder what is real after all, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think we're living in a hologramic situation, virtual reality, and I outlined that in my liner notes. I think everything disappeared. The mixed corporate media's icons disappeared by 1977. We've, since 1977, lived in the after images of those technical icons. And then from 1990 on, we've come into everything's disappeared to the third degree of simulation.
I've often thought how fun it would be to go around and do interviews of prominent, serious, literal-minded people and play the same games with them that I played with the guy on the airplane.
Well, you get it on the talk shows every day. I mean, all you're getting is people's personal point of view, and a point of view is obsolete today. It's narcissistic, it's solipsistic, You cannot communicate to people beyond yourself if you're working from a point of view, and I would call that being literal. You think you have a body. You think your mind is made up of one little thing. You're not aware that you are wearing satellites, computers, and all the information inside it. You've absorbed it into your being, and that's very hard to image, to visualize what that anthropomorphic body looks like. So people retreat to banal Phil Donahue running around grabbing each person's and recording for history each person's opinion. And that is a shit shoveling activity.
Right. And the problem is that all of these talk shows, while they seem to be and while they perhaps even convinced themselves in the beginning that they were actually doing something therapeutic for society, it ends up becoming, pathology as entertainment, essentially.
That's right. And now this is the communication ecology of tetrad management. Since we are into a global utopia, a global discarnate state of peace, that we've numbed ourselves into oblivion, and that could be considered a state of ecstasy, or it could be, considered apocalyptic. But as an antidote to that, we feature sound bites of the range of emotions and opinions and mental intensity as an antidote to the numbness we're experiencing. So it actually serves a harmless function. So you become psychotic talking heads as an anti-environment to the death that's already experienced. It's like going through the bardos.
Yes. So how could we create a better society? I mean, if we believe in the power of irony and satire, is it possible to actually, train an army of satiric warrior, clown warriors, wounded healers, and court jesters to somehow redeem society? Do you suppose we can do that?
Yeah, what you just said sounds like a description of the United Nations armed forces. But no, seriously, when I think of the complexity of the situation, I can project that paradigm or that little agenda you just said on all kinds of people or all kinds of forces in society that are doing that. But then you can take the spiritual view that heaven is here, the moment is now, and all the Zen stuff that Alan Watts talks about, and you could say, well, personally, we will never collectively achieve something, but privately one can achieve a better world for themselves through perception. But I think we feel that's inadequate. And I think that's because the collective media has so given the individual electric autonomous that every one of us is a super monarch of our environments, and we actually feel we could orchestrate, like Orpheus, we could tune the whole world. And that's a hidden bias of people who want to change the world. This is like very powerful on people today. They feel every one of us can do something better to change the world. And we're not looking at the context, the environment that makes us feel that. And therefore that causes confusion in capitalizing on our goals. So I always like to point out the context of what we're operating in. So that because we're so fragmented and decentralized, you actually could get an army of clowns, however you design those clowns, and communicate to a lot of people. And you could say, we've successfully helped change 450 people over a five-year period. Why not say that? Well, that's stupendous. That's quite an accomplishment. You see, the numbers are relative. I mean, Michael Jackson, he gave delight, I guess, to millions of kids or teenagers for 10 years.
And possibly some on a personal basis.
That's right, yeah. And so the what I call homeopathy, and then you get the word holeopathic, you take the hologram world we live in, and if you dilute it to homeopathic levels, then the tinier it is, the more potent it is. So you merge hologram and homeopathy, and you get a holeopathic situation. All right? So maybe the less success you have in marketing yourself to a bigger audience is actually more potent in affecting consciousness.
So that means there are a lot of sick ghosts walking around.
Sick ghosts. Ghosts.
Ghosts. Holograms.
Yes. Yeah. The planet of the dead has been going on since 1977. So there are sick ghosts, but there are also hungry ghosts and And the ecstatic ghost is all kinds of ghosts. And yeah, you don't know what kind of effect your communication, your agenda, your theater could have on them. And you actually, you could say, you can't tell how successful you've been, even if all the world has said you were successful. So, like, we can't measure anything. So I think you can carry on with total freedom of goals. You can claim you're changing the whole world.
It seems that that there's a rampant disease that we might call fundamentalism, of both a political and a religious variety, that seems to grip the public during certain stages of economic paranoia.
Right.
And
that's normal sociological knowledge, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth.
Yes.
Okay, that's like collective phobia. You know, in the 60s, there wasn't as much collective phobia because there was more money. Now there's less. That is, just taking that cliche knowledge, we could say, yeah, that's a truism. And it's interesting that I'd then be forced to think in those terms and have to respond to them. But the fluidity of the TV age is that ideas are obsolete. Patterns are obsolete. To notice things, the pattern you notice is obsolete. So I can float in the fluidity of listening to all different kinds of cliches. For example, the one you just said. And that could be a very addictive process. So I point out that pattern recognition is obsolete, and the way to really get people in a painful state of self-recognition would be to turn off the fluid state we're in.
And then,
I agree with it, what you're saying, but it's a tiny pattern that is hard to live with.
And then what? I mean, in other words, okay, so we temporarily turn off television, and we...
And then you could say the same to me as I just said to you. Then what?
Yes.
See, that's the problem. It's hard for us to live with the then what situation, the restricted fluidity that we have. So I think that...
So if we were to create an ideal atmosphere where we could actually have, you know, some positive change, what would you propose? I mean, what would be the elements that you would suggest would be the most valuable to create a new society?
Okay, I was just to finish the thought I was saying.
Yeah.
If I can remember it, which leads into that, is I simplified, I laid out the media ecology agenda, just like you're laying out the cyclical thing. I guess cyclical in the seriousness of the population and the sense of lightheadedness or humorousness of the population, the cyclical point. Okay, I brought up the other cyclical point of the technological ground of media ecology. When you say it, you say your point or I say mine, it doesn't have any staying power. So because we're inside an environment that doesn't allow any position to have hegemony for very long, or hegemony. You see what I'm saying? Because the environment processes all patterns and all points of view. So to get out of that situation, I don't think we can. And so I say that we're that war and peace are simultaneously at hand. And to have a better world, it seriously can be questioned whether that's possible. But I think one can personally have a better world in one's perception of it.
By doing what?
Well, studying me.
Okay, well, you're more ironic than I thought you were.
Well, it's called Manippean satire, which is a certain kind of satire. Mm-hmm. But the... yes, I mean, I can come on as an agenda, but I'm ready to cancel out my agenda and give people personal satisfaction in perceiving me and getting humor out of it.
As a satirist, you might get the same comment from people that I often get from people, which is that people are always saying to me, you always say always, or you always say never, type of a thing. And you tend to exaggerate. And
yes.
And I say, well, yes, of course, I'm a hyperbolist. I mean, that's my job. I mean, that's part of my function and mission in life, is to take something that I seem to see as true and blow it out of proportion to make it more than it actually is, so that we can hopefully get out of that dangerous mode of thought.
That's right. That's what a metaphor is for. Man's reach must exceed his grasp, or what's a metaphor?
Yes.
Yeah, so you, yeah, that's the nature of language. This is what's really interesting about the form and content of language. The form of speaking is an exaggeration. The content of it is an exaggeration. And we now have new languages that exaggerate either visual space, kinetic space, or tactile space. And these exaggerations are the bias of the metaphor that's created. And so communication of the new is a miracle, but not impossible. So, yeah, you can also say to them when they say that, well, I got to use words when I talk to you.
And we'll continue momentarily with Contemporary Communications Conference with Jeffrey Hill, author of the book Illuminating Shadows, The Mythic Power of Film, and Bob Dobbs, author of the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Hi, welcome back to Contemporary Communications Conference. We welcome Jeffrey Hill, psychotherapist, social critic, and author of the book Illuminating Shadows, The Mythic Power of Film, and Bob Dobbs, a mixed corporate media and author of the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Jeffrey, could you read a paragraph from Bob's book?
Yes, I'm reading from his book here on page 5. If a language contrived and used by many people as a mass medium, any one of our new media is in a sense a new language, a new codification of experience collectively achieved by new work habits and inclusive collective awareness. But when such a new codification has reached the technological stage of communicability and repeatability, has it not, like a spoken tongue, also become a macro myth? How much compression of the elements of a process must occur before one can say that they are certainly in mythic form? Are we inclined to insist that myth be a reduction of collective experience to a visual and classifiable form? Let me continue. Languages, old and new, as macromyths, have that relation to words and word-making that characterizes the full scope of myth. The collective skills and experience that constitute both spoken languages and such new languages as movies or radio can also be considered with preliterate myths as static models of the universe. But do they not tend, like languages in general, to be dynamic models of the universe in action? As such, languages old and new would seem to be for participation rather than for contemplation or for reference and classification.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was written by Marshall McLuhan in 1959.
And what does that mean, Bob?
Well, that's the essence of my liner notes, the memo to Prince Charles, is understanding myth as the medium that the society uses, not just a sort of an anthropomorphic story referring to gods or bacteria, you know, from myth, traditional myth, Greek myth to science, but the form of communication society uses is a metaphor and compression of the society's experience, which one participates in.
That seems to be a very, very key word there. As the sentence in the book says, it says, as such, language as old and new would seem to be for participation rather than contemplation or for reverence and classification. I think that's highly significant because I think, in my opinion, we have very, very much lost the concept, or we've lost the act of participation.
Yeah, now see, that's where I'd equivocate, because television is a very participatory medium on the sensory level, because your eye has to make the image out of the cathode ray tube. It's projecting an image into the bombardment of electrons and pulses. And so television creates a participatory bias. It's called the participation mystique in society. And that's why the traditional say passive institutions of family and work are in this turmoil because everybody wants to participate in all kinds of and different roles in society today. So the paradox here is that the participation of myth has been extended to extreme exaggeration in the participatory mode of television. Now, most people, I acknowledge, see TV as a passive activity, but they're thinking in terms of the content in one way broadcasting. Something is being sent to people as a package for consumption. But the medium itself, and also you could say telephones, computers, and that, the whole electric spectrum of technologies create a society that's very participatory and very involved in defining and making an image of itself. And one example of that is inflation. If you put money in a computer environment at the speed of light, then a dollar acquires the impact of $1 million. So that requires a lot of filling in by people. As the crowd gets more inflated, it feels like it's getting smaller and smaller. So as a point of critique, I'd say what you just expressed about the lack of participation in modern society is an effect of this super participatory, this super audience eating itself alive.
Yes, I agree. And when I say we've lost our active participation, I mean, I'm really talking about in the more overt, obvious, primitive sort of sense. However, we are...
Anthropomorphic, yeah, on a human scale level.
Yeah. However, I do agree that we are very, very much participating in the electronic media in a more ironic way than we would care to realize.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad you realize that. Then we can work from there, maybe get some common ground on what we're talking about. Cause, so to get the human scale of participation that you are... bemoaning and would like to see retrieved would require turning off the extreme electric participation we're in now.
Yes, and getting back to perhaps a more original form of participation. What I'd like to do, I'd like to, Jerry, could you read this paragraph out of, okay, he'd rather not do it, I'll do it.
Thank you.
You do it, your voice.
Very good reader, Jeffrey, thank you.
Okay, I'll read out of my own book here.
As a juxtaposition to what we just read.
Well, as perhaps an addition to it.
Okay.
When we allow ourselves to be fully taken in by a film, we experience all of the emotions that the primitive goes through during his or her ceremony with the witch doctor. The witch doctor, in our case, is the filmmaker under whose spell we willingly surrender. In our modern trance state, we feel elated, we feel scared, threatened, we become horrified. We anticipate psychic healing and receive it. We call up the ghost of a cosmic hero. We vicariously benefit from the heroic exploits of our totemic ancestors. We are wooed, comforted, and romanced all within the space of 100 minutes. In essence, we allow ourselves to be taken over by a spell that is as real and potent as the trance state of the primitive. We become possessed with the spirits of good and ill according to the enchanting magic of the celluloid shaman. While we have largely left the formal rituals of possession and trance states behind in our modern denial of religion, we have not killed the numinous powers that haunted our religions of yore. In fact, the more we try to eliminate the religious ghosts of our naive and primitive past, the more those ghosts will overwhelm us. And so I guess what I'm really saying there is that we will participate either in an ironic fashion or in an original act, but nonetheless we all participate whether we realize it or not.
Yeah, now I would say this, using the Gestalt terms figure and ground, the ground is the medium the society uses, and that's always changing through evolutionary history. The figure is man, and by that I mean, you know, humankind, people. People are the content of each ground in each society, and the people, or man, always is the content and never changes. The condition of man never changes, just his conditions change. The conditions are the grounds and the medium. So you're pointing out with that paragraph that though the medium, that there's a categorical mistake going on here, where we think we are not primitive or that they're doing something different from what we're doing in the 20th century. The commonality is that both experience the medium as a message and as a massage in history. And the content is always man responding to that. And that's the same kind of stimulus-response pattern of getting involved.
Well, I think it's, you know, when most people in society don't even know the difference between medium and media, it would be very difficult for them to understand the concepts that we're talking about.
Yeah. Do you want to say them, define them?
Well, media being the singular and media obviously being the plural.
Yeah. Many people, they talk about mediums when they refer to the plural. They don't know that the singular word medium has a plural called media.
Right.
But they think of media, the word, as like a slang word that refers to news or something.
Yes.
Something out there agitating them.
Yes.
They think of a particular medium, they'll call it a medium.
Yes.
So there's the source of that confusion in people. And, you know, very educated people, people involved in Hollywood use the word erroneously.
Even people in the media.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole concept of participation is just a very, very fascinating topic to me, and I think it's really at the heart and soul of what's wrong with our society today. It's almost as if there is a very large monster with excessively bad taste that has come along and caused us to participate in various media that we... that have essentially robbed us of our soul.
We've been possessed, yeah. There's a huge exorcism required of this possession that's taken place.
Yes.
And the ironic thing is that we've possessed ourselves with extensions of ourselves.
That's right.
You know, television's not an alien invader. It is us.
That's right.
And maybe because it's us, it's so intimate that we can't recognize it, so we project it out as the other.
Right.
You know, the Jungian other. And, yeah, I agree, the popularity of horror movies and that is an antidote to the basic feeling people have that they have been possessed, vampirized.
Right. So when we go into archaic civilizations, they often have these seemingly naive beliefs, for example, that if you take their picture with a camera, that camera technology will somehow steal their soul. Whereas in our postmodern world, we... instead of believing that that anything like that would happen to us, I think more figuratively not so much the camera that captures our picture steals our soul, but rather the image technology that projects images toward us, such as the television, in a sense steals our soul.
Yep. I would like to work with the word soul. I would say that... on a human level, in this dimension, empirically, we could define soul as memory. And the storage of memory is language. And so primitive people, what we call primitive people, preliter people, use spoken language and kinetic dance and body rhythms to work up a sense of participation and hypnotism. What's interesting is that you then can say that the alphabet came in and created a new hidden language, a new soul, or added a twist to the soul. The soul is a memory system, a retrieval system, a storage system of the group's culture, of the group's memories, of the group's experience. Then the soul mutates whenever a new medium comes in. So it went through a mutation when writing came in. In the West, it was mutated even more specifically by the phonetic alphabet as opposed to previous ideogrammic writing modes. And then, to move along faster, the printing press changed the soul of the West, and then the newspaper, then the telegraph, and the movie, and the telephone, and the radio, and the television, and the computer, each altered the collective soul. And it altered the language of people using those media. So we can talk about soul in the religious sense, or the mystical sense, but I like to keep it, since everybody can use it the way I'm defining it, as a medium, as a linguistic medium, because it bypasses religious bias. You know what I'm saying?
Not exactly. I've been participating with the shamans. I'm just joking.
Okay, so you are, in other words, you do understand me.
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, it's definitely true that we've gone through this evolution of consciousness that's brought us to the point where we are today.
Of soul, of evolution.
Yes.
Of soul.
Yes. I think what we forget, however, is that we somehow like to think of ourselves as these, you know, this modern technocratic civilization that's somehow devoid of this mystical element that we call the soul or the spirit.
Well, that was the Gutenberg galaxy soul.
Yes.
Embedded man in matter, made matter opaque, and he lost the transparency of matter, which is common to pre-literate people. They weren't so visually biased in the past, alphabetically biased. So now we're into a transparent period again through electricity or through television, an X-raying of our collective past, and therefore the establishment becomes the definition of science and that limited view of matter and the soul. So that's a baggage that's being continuously eroded, and if we don't demand it to be changed today, we can prophesy that it will be changed within 100 years, that your metaphor for the soul will come back.
Yes. You know, it's interesting that in the Greek culture, when the actors were putting on the great Greek tragedies in the outdoor theaters, all of the actors, the directors, all of the people that participated or that put on the plays...
The persona?
Yes. They thought of themselves as priests of the culture, almost as if, you know, the entire society participated in the mythos of the tribe, as it were. And they literally thought of themselves as the priest that somehow had wisdom and illumination to impart to the rest of the tribe. But then when the Roman world came into existence, that is when they kind of militarized and took over from the Greek world, of course they adopted most of the religious culture and political culture, but made it even more organized and more militarized. At that point, there was a shift that took place in the theater at that point, rather than a point of spiritual elucidation, essentially became mere entertainment. And I think the very same shift has taken place with us, is that, or perhaps we've just never come out of that militaristic mode. I think that the militaristic mode and entertainment go hand in hand, and that we're entertained to death or we're killed to death with the military, take your pick. But our soul is dead.
Yeah. That Madison Avenue is a military operation.
That's right.
Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jackson, David Bowie, even for the alternative world, Frank Zappa, are military operations where the entertainment software world hijacks that image and
yes.
Poses on people. That sense seems to be a bias in maybe Western society, maybe in all societies. We have the right to propagate, to spread our information, our source of enjoyment and pattern recognition on all kinds of people. That would seem to be hard to get people to give up the idea that they have the freedom of speech, the freedom to impose their cultural bias on other people and to propagate.
And if anybody doubts that Madison Avenue is a military, all they need to do is to look at the activities of some place like the CIA. I mean, essentially, the CIA is basically the private army of the Fortune 500 corporations that perpetuate the entertainment on a duped public.
Yeah, and you could see the CIA in particular runs the hardware world, the hardware communist world, and advertising is the brain control, mind control of the software communist world.
Exactly.
And by communist, I mean a shared environment that nobody can really hijack. No private person, David Rockefeller, could not create a whole TV network just for himself. So the software world, it cannot be bought, sold, or stolen. So it's communistic in the sense that everybody shares in it, into the means of production. And polling is the means of production. And then the old 19th century world of hardware communism arrived before Marx was 20 years old.
Right. Well, I see the advertising world is essentially a rather massive and fraudulent system whereby the, shall we say, the elite causes brings the tribe into this inauthentic participation.
Yeah. Now, I would say that we are offering pattern recognition here, and the hidden satire for me is that I know that our ideas will entertain whoever listens to this and provide content, it actually keeps the system going. So I'm willing to stop talking as a political agenda, as to stop providing entertainment as part of a media fast. And I know that requires the termination of my explanation of things and yours. So the irony of it is that we are continuously restating what is obvious to everybody, maybe not in, in sophistication of the ability to express it verbally, but I think everybody understands and feels ripped off by this software bombardment.
Yes, yeah, but they don't, I don't think they can, most of them can really articulate it, though.
No, they can't. They articulate it in their lifestyles. They feel they maybe watch Donahue every day to get a sense of what's going on. They maybe don't watch TV. They listen to Rush Limbaugh. Or they play golf. Or they join the Peace Corps. Or they do drugs. You know, everybody has a particular unique, you know, natural individualistic response to the situation, which has a bias. That particular response is biased.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to get to the state where language is talking about language. In other words, I'm not projecting my personal point of view here. I'm not trying to aggrandize with new pattern recognition, but to sort of state the thing articulately and then hope the population picks up on the ESP I'm creating as something.
Yes.
Which includes cancellation of me.
Yeah, well, that would take a lot of discipline, I would suppose.
Well, that's why I'm doing it, because I'm 72 years old and I'm qualified to do it. I've had many years of discipline. I consider this the new yoga, tetrad management, orchestrating media from the Secret Council 10 level, and I'm good at that.
Yes. I have this concept that, you know, going back with your evolution of consciousness that you were referring to earlier.
Yeah, the soul.
Yeah. I kind of put the history of Western consciousness into, shall we say, a quaternity or a mandala, in that I look at the beginning of consciousness back in the archaic world. So if we can draw a circle in our minds with...
Are you going to talk about Gebser?
About what?
Are you aware of Gebser?
No.
It's a four-stage level beginning with the term archaic. Okay, I'm wondering if you're going to do Gebser.
I'm not familiar with him, no. At any rate, I would put the archaic world over to the left of the circle, and then classicism we would put up at the zenith at the top of the circle, with the classical Greek world and so forth. Eventually, down at the third quarter of the cycle, we would put modernism, or the industrial age, and all that went along with that. And then eventually, down at the last quarter of the circle, down at the nadir at the bottom, we would put postmodernism, where we find ourselves today. Of course, the joke on postmodernism is that, as you probably heard, a man comes up to a woman and says, "My, you have a nice-looking child." And she says, "Oh, that's nothing. You should see his photograph."
Yeah.
And so the problem is that we have lost participation. We merely have the image of the image of the image, and we've lost the original participation back to the archaic world. And since this postmodern age down at the bottom is, in essence, the end of consciousness, at least as I tend to view it, I think the only redemption that I see that's hopeful for us is to regain the archaic mindset, to somehow revive us with whatever we can gain to come back to natural participation.
Yeah, now that's where I quibble with your terms, because I say that we've had an archaic revival through most of the 20th century. The meaning of archaic can be patterned onto the 20th century as a retrieved society. Those four stages you're talking about can be considered to be happening all at the same time right now, you know, under computer TV conditions. All times and historical points are simultaneously present, including possible future situations. Now, I could argue about the term archaic, but I don't know how long do we have or how much to go into it, but let's say I accept what you said. You can carry on.
Well, I would say if we can have enough faith to perhaps promulgate that idea, I think there's a lot, and in fact, I think it's already happening in many different circles, is that we need to ask ourselves, what is it that we can learn from the archaic world?
Don't you have a sense of irony as you say this? Don't you feel that words are failing you? I mean, you're coming on like a fundamentalist. You're saying that, like Terence McKenna, who's a psychedelic fundamentalist, that a certain part of history should be retrieved and would restore a sense of something, a sacredness or participatory nature. Don't you feel silly as you're saying this and imagining this being broadcast to hundreds of people, different kinds of people in different stages of technological evolution, Don't you think you're? Don't you feel limited as you're talking? You can go on talking, but how much are you aware of the irony of the situation as you present this?
Well, it depends on how literally people would take me. In other words, I'm not suggesting that we need to don our loincloths and go out into the jungles and beat our drums and join the men's movement and do all of that sort of thing. As much as I enjoy beating on drums,
what are you suggesting?
Well, I'm suggesting that while we need to revive an original participation, we cannot at the same time eliminate all that's gone before us in the modern and the classical world. In other words, we need to accept the fact of where we are and acknowledge that without denying it, yet at the same time revive some of the original participation in order to redeem the disease that we have fallen into.
Yeah, and I would say it would be hard for you to measure the increase of that kind of desirable participation. It would be hard for you to measure that in relation to other things that are going on, because there are probably 1,000 people who already do that. Now, do you want 5 billion people to do that? And if they did it, wouldn't they have to lop off modern environments, postmodern environments? You see, how far... You will never know if your agenda is achieved or not, and you could be satisfied if you got 5 people to do what you feel is ideal.
Well, as I said, it's already being done in many different circles. Like, for example, many of the people in the women's spirituality movement, many of the people in the New Age movement, the environmental movement, etc. I mean, they're all going back to more earth-based ideologies to some degree. And I don't necessarily support all of those movements. However, I do applaud their wish to somehow transcend the omnipotence of technology that's overwhelmed us.
Right. Now, that phrase is important, the omnipotence of technology. But you did say earlier you recognize how we are not going to get rid of that situation other than through the natural technological evolution into nanotechnology, where technology will be miniaturized and pretty soon we'll have a whole satellite environment inside our wristwatch. And so we actually are going to get to the possibility of retrieving Paleolithic times with our technology, but we have to acknowledge that technology did that.
Yes. Yeah, no. So don't get the wrong idea. I'm not denying our technological existence. What I'm saying is we need to just wake up and realize what it is that we're participating in, either realistically or ironically.
Well, don't you think people know that? See, you're looking for empirical evidence of that waking up.
Empirical evidence?
Yeah, some kind of manifestation that's different from today's manifestation. Right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose I would hope for some type of social change.
Okay, but there's all kinds of change going on in different ways. There are people who become many selves in a 40-year period. They put on many movements, wear many kind of ideologies. They move through them. I call it metaphysical promiscuity. And they actually don't stop at any one of them. Or some do stop for a while and become rigid and fundamentalist. But the thing is, look at the changes people go through. I think that change is the norm. We actually maybe need non-change.
Expound on that. What do you mean?
I would say non-change would be impossible to achieve, but it could be realized intellectually, mentally, perceptually, however one considers the part of the mind that understands. I think that we don't need any more change. We need an understanding of the changes we've been put through.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things I'm saying we do need, but we also need change in conjunction with that.
And it's hard to measure because there's a big mythic stage of chemistry and pharmaceutical companies who believe that they're going to be able to invent compounds that will eat up pollution.
Yeah.
Now, how much can you stop them from that enterprise? They may be wrong, but I think there's a certain historical momentum that favors the scientific enterprise. And even though I support alternative science, alternative medicine and those things, maybe they will merge and mysticism will become tomorrow's science. But it's hard to tell anybody today, other than you know you're doing it ironically, and you go ahead and propagate like you are now. You propagate, and you carry on and see what the effects of it are, even maybe homeopathically. you'll have an effect, or homeopathically.
Well, going back to our previous conversation on irony and satire, I think a good antidote for the ideology that there's better living through chemistry would be to, for example, develop chemical theaters, as it were, to go out and chemicalize the entire sphere of the particular acting troupe or whatever to show the ridiculousness of the idea of the logical conclusion of the ideology.
Right, and you could also form theater groups to satirize the ethereal chemistry of news broadcasting. Where, if you take Arthur Croker, who uses the metaphor of genetic cloning, splicing, transcribing, and sequencing, that genetic metaphor is happening, that chemical metaphor is happening in the processing of information today. So you wouldn't want to just satirize the chemical factories. You could also orchestrate armies to satirize the software chemistry.
Yes, yes. Well, let me ask you this, Bob. If you would say we're in two or three prominent myths today in our Western consciousness, what comes to mind? I mean, what would you say would be the major structural myths that we operate in now?
Okay, in the West, the European, North American.
Yes.
Yeah. I would say there's two kinds of myth. There's a structural myth, which is outlined by explained by the McLuhan quote. And that's the medium you use. And so on the structural level of myth, and then I'll give the content myth. The structural myth is hardware communism versus software communism. Or in simple terms, industry versus information. Or practical nuts and bolts of driving your car and repairing it to listening to the radio. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So the two structural myths that are in battle are the hardware communist environment and the software communist. The content in the West is a battle between the liberal and the conservative. The liberal has a faith in truth, whereas the conservative, his myth is that the truth is found in faith. So the battle is between Howard Stern's dedication to truth and Rush Limbaugh's dedication to a faith in an environment, in a situation, in a historical legacy. That, I'd say that's the anthropomorphic content. And man is always the content. Humankind, people are always the content. It is conceptualized in the battle of that, the liberal and the conservative.
Yeah.
But they're operating in two structural myths, the environments themselves, that cancel out the hegemony of either one of the liberal or conservative myths.
That's interesting. So one has a truth in faith, and the other has a faith in truth.
Yes.
Oh, I'd like to remind our listeners we're listening to Jeffrey Hill and Bob Dobbs.
And I'm Jeff.
That's a good one. Well, that's an interesting analysis of our current mythos.
Okay, you give me your structure.
Well, I think that we're in several of them. One that comes to my mind is this concept that we seem to be in a dichotomy over order versus chaos. On one hand, we have this tremendous sense of order about society where everything seems to be so organized and so militarized to keep it all in order, which is this...
That'd be hardware communism.
Yes, exactly. I suppose it would be very similar to yours. And then the other would be chaos as opposed to the order.
And that's software communism, even
yes.
more prominent in the 80s and 90s with cable TV and the fragmentation of entertainment, right?
Yes, yes. And, in fact, fragmentation is a good word because I think that really signifies the total breaking down or the eruption of the chaos in the midst of all of the industrial organization that, under which we are oppressed.
And you can make a pun on in the midst... In the midst.
Yes.
The midst of all the myths.
That's right. Yes. So it seems that we're looking at a mythos, which is perhaps the same one from a slightly different metaphorical standpoint.
Yeah. And I would call that metaphorical standpoint a mythic stage. You have your conceptual references that would support your definition that way. And I'd have my historical references, and I'm not committed to them, but I'm just saying that's the structure and definition of what I mean by mythic stage.
I suppose from a sexual standpoint, one could say it's also the masculinized or the feminized worlds.
Yeah, but I think that the relevant point I'd make in relation to any dialectic, especially that one, is to point out in the postmodern situation, we don't have a body in male or female terms. All entities on the planet have a discarnate body, which is wearing this software environment. So that's why the male and female metaphors on either side fail to express or mirror the situation we're in.
Yes.
As long as we have an electric environment.
It reminds me of a line in a movie I saw where they were a little bit confused with computers as to why it is that the software goes into the hardware, whereas in real life it seems to be the reverse.
Well, that is the revenge of Echo over Narcissus.
That's right.
The right hemisphere environment we're in is favoring the traditional image of the feminine and the reality cliches of the feminine. So Echo gets her revenge. It's President Hillary.
Yes, isn't that amazing? Yes. Well, what if you were to suggest, Bob, a mythos that we could perhaps subscribe to and participate in that might somehow make a difference, what would that be?
Well, when I say it's me, the content of me is the 10 holy offices, which I outline on my liner notes to the album of Bob's Mediacology. And I do a tetrad. I show the ecology of consciousness, the interrelationship of each holy office in relation to each other, and at what point one holy office is useful to emphasize, and what other holy offices, when that first one is emphasized, are obsolesced or retrieved. So you can follow the 10 sources of pattern recognition in my liner notes that I advocate as heroic, holiopathic, retrieval, holy offices. These are heroic people, heroic sources of pattern recognition that I think will provide endless energy and resuscitation to anybody's virtual reality that they're living right now. If we want to name them, we can go ahead, but I don't know.
So it's kind of like a Gideon's army of shamanistic computer hacks.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that would be a good thing that could help us a lot. There's another framework that I often use in analyzing the mythos of our current ideologies, which is fundamentalism versus spirituality, or mysticism.
Yes.
Which really is, I think, the same dichotomy that we find ourselves in, and I think we could use several other analogies to bring out the dichotomy. The problem is that most of us just simply don't recognize this split in our collective and personal souls to recognize the disease.
Yeah, I agree. And what would be, to see if you've picked up anything from what I'm saying, what would be the ground that this battle between the fundamentalist and the spiritualist is operating in?
The ground, as opposed to the...
As I've explained it.
Yeah.
What would I say in response to what you just said?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Well, I'd say the ground is that the battle between the fundamentalist and the spiritualist is the electric discarnate state we're in.
Okay. In other words, the fact that we're so... That we're so fragmented as a result of being mediaized to death that we don't know where to go anymore?
Yeah, and that both the spiritual metaphor and the fundamentalist metaphor are would be rearview mirror mythic stages that a certain kind of personality will latch onto and fight each other as content that Dan Rather can make polls out of and run elections on.
Exactly, yes. And the problem is there again, too, is that while we are convinced that the polls of these seeming opposites of, for example, Republicans versus Democrats are, you know, somehow the true polls of ideology, in actuality, they're really much closer together than most people realize.
Yeah, but the world is... moving at the speed of light and beyond. I mean, that's not a great metaphor anymore, but the sense of motion allows no time to distinguish the differences and similarities of that situation, of that debate.
So we've speeded up so fast, it's like when we're traveling electronically at the speed of light, and are, in the meanwhile, we're like breaking up, as it were. We're going through...
Fractalizing.
Yes, exactly. So while we're so ordered in our electronic, militarized industrial speed, we don't recognize that our spirits somehow, this fractalizing that you're talking about, or fragmentation along with it, is actually the necessary chaos that would bring us the wherewithal to somehow integrate the split that we find ourselves in.
I got a thought there. It's actually, this is the communication ecology of tetrad management. The chaos we are creating right now may be a rite of passage that will toughen us up to retrieve the values you're advocating.
Okay, and how do we get that?
Well, just that sentence, the way you said it, the chaos we're moving through may create new forms of society, well, inevitably will, that will be better than any traditional imaginary scenario could think of. We may become more spiritual beings and less fundamentalist and more flexible within the next 100 years due to the demands placed on a global theater, a global society, a planetary culture. And each generation, every 20, 30 years, will be more flexible, and the battles of the latter 20th century will appear quite futile, and the outcome is already determined as long as we get the electric environment still processing us. So that is the Gnostic advantage of the television environment.
Yes.
And I'm talking over the next 50, 100 years. So one has to decide at what point one's going to sort of engage in the battle where the outcome is already predetermined. I think Gnosticism will win.
Well, I hope so, too. I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily hoping for that. I think that we'll need an anti-environment to that, which will be a retrieved Catholicism. But that's my personal response.
Yeah.
So I don't identify with what's happening in the future.
Yeah.
But I do put on certain identifications in dialogue.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And somehow, I mean, you know, when I tend to lean in the direction of shall we say, the software side or the mystical side or whatever, I'm not necessarily saying we need to eliminate the other, because that's always been the problem. I mean,
yeah.
You know, feminists hang themselves as the moment that they call themselves feminist.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I would make the same mistake. It would just be more obvious if I called myself a masculinist.
Well, that's why you could say today is the most spiritual condition mankind could be in, because we have such a cancellation of polarities and the inability of any polarity to have hegemony, so that we actually are in a very futuristic, idealistic situation today.
That's right, whether we realize it or not.
Yeah, and if we weren't afraid of death, then we could see that souls are reincarnating and experiencing misery in certain levels in our planet as just for the probe of experience.
That's right.
Because yeah. It frightens everybody to think if we get to a paradisical world, because everybody thinks it'll be unified and boring. Now, that's probably erroneous, but that seems to be a hindrance in people's personalities and temperaments, and that's why they persist on being evil.
Right.
And
exactly.
Keep smoking.
Yes.
There's this basic stubbornness of the human nature.
Right. You know, regarding this split, what we forget about this split, which is often, of course, as you know, called the Cartesian split, or what I often call the Augustinian split.
Yeah.
Actually, what most of us don't realize is that it goes back much, much further into ancient mythology. In fact, as I'm sure you're aware, the creation myths the world over depict this split, which is, for example, in the first chapter of Genesis, where it talks about the separation between the firmament above and the firmament below, which right there at the beginning of Western consciousness in written form is essentially this same dichotomy.
Yeah, you aware of the book The Time Falling Bodies Take Delight?
Oh, yes, I've read it.
That's a very good historical, cultural pun on that historical fact.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
By William Irwin Thompson.
Yes, yeah, he's a good thinker. But along with that, what we've also forgotten is besides the fact that the split is practically inevitable in our mythic structure, actually, Eric Neumann points out in his book, The Origin and History of Consciousness, that in this myth of the split parents, which is essentially the divorce of the world parents, the Father God and Mother Earth, so to speak, what usually happens in the myth is that the hero must, which is the son of the of these mythic these cosmic parents, the hero must slay one or both parents, which is of course the mythic dragon slain. But the problem is that we only have the death of the parents, or sometimes the death of the hero, and we never get to the point of redemption, which is that after the dragon slain, there's usually a certain reconciliation and healing of the soul. Well, in our particular split, in our industrial informational mindset, we tend to lean only in the direction of the perpetuation of Thanatos, and we never get to embrace, to embrace death in order that we can come to the point of Eros and reconciliation or life.
Yeah, and the computerized environment has fragmented society to the point that maybe the saviors of this situation will be women.
Well, I think there's a certain
amount... saying the fragmentation, the dismantling of the patriarchy has created a vacuum or an opening to allow women to bring in an antidote to that traditional mythic structure you're talking about.
Well, I think there's a certain amount of truth in that. Not so much that we can find our salvation in women, but at least I think the many of the women's writers today are speaking a lot of truth when they are reviving a certain amount of the goddess ideology.
Yeah, and that's why I claim I'm a woman.
Yeah.
I'd like to be a candidate to be a one of the saviors of our situation, so I have to at least assume a woman persona.
Uh-huh, yeah. This new
A black woman.
Yes, this new film, The Piano. Have you seen that, Bob?
Not yet. I've heard about it.
Well, it's very good. And actually, from beginning to end, I was overwhelmed with this sense of the juiciness of the narrative, and that there's a tremendous amount of mud and darkness and water and mist and rain and so forth, people falling down in mud puddles and so forth. And I got the impression that I was inside of a big, wet, juicy vagina throughout the entire story. And, of course, that's the part of the underlying myth of the story, is that the woman ends up being pulled apart between, on one hand, this man that represents the modern Western industrial technocratic mindset, as opposed to Harvey Keitel's character, who has tattoos on his nose. In other words, he has gone native to some degree.
Yeah.
He's an Englishman that has participated with the Maoris in New Zealand. And the woman is actually more drawn toward him because he's essentially much more in tune with the old pagan matriarchal mindset.
And you can see he's actually targeted the right style of demographic. He's put on the muddy female element, and therefore
yes,
he has an advantage.
That's right.
And so that's clever marketing of himself. It's like Norman Mailer's novel, Advertisements for Myself. The Harvey Keitel character has figured out, has listened to Bob's Meteorology, figured out that the right hemispheric feminine fifth element of mud is going to dominate in the tactile mood we live in, so he's put on the appropriate image. Now, does the movie sort of become a commercial for adopting Keitel's strategy, or does it show disservices of a situation as well as the disservices of the other protagonist?
No, I think it's a. I think for those that would interpret it the way the writers that I would guess that the writer would like it to be read would be that that the feminine element definitely wins out.
Yeah. So see, that's the bias of the '90s, is that
yes,
woman is going to be the last sex, and that ideology will be genetically cloned all over the place in all media. Roseanne rules.
Well, then maybe we should get a sex change.
No, then you're being too literal. The new situation is that that ideology, that image of anthropomorphic image of women as echoes revenge in our savior, will run its course because the hidden ground is that, well, we don't have any bodies and we are discarnate patterns of information now. So the women, as they take over, as Hillary becomes, you know, President Billary, she has to realize that her time is limited and a new form will show up later.
Actually, I've always thought I was an accountant trapped in an artist's body.
You're talking personally?
Yeah.
And is that due to the college you went to?
No, I'm just joking, of course.
I'm being serious as part of the joke.
on that note, we would like to conclude Contemporary Communication Conference. We thank...
Oh, Fialdo, you're always interrupting, just when it gets good.
We would like to thank Jeffrey Hill, psychotherapist, social critic, and author of the book Illuminating Shadows, The Mythic Power of Film, and Bob Dobbs, a mixed corporate media, and author of the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. For more information, you can write me, Jerry Fialka, at 2427½ Glendon, Glyndon Avenue, Venice, California, 90291. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Thank you for participating in Contemporary Communication Conference.